the quality of our conception is very important. And the quality of conception gains power when it's consistent with our acuity of perception. So that the more that we bring conception into continuity, or perhaps I should use the architectonic word, tensegrity. Bucky Fuller used to love the word tensegrity. Tensegrity is when the structure of the form is exactly what the dynamics of allowing the form to express its content are. So tensegrity is where form and content are the same. In geometric language, they would be congruent. So that a colloquial expression of it is that form follows function, but in a more intensive emphasis, the function is the form. And then you have tensegrity, then you have continuity. Well, when thought and its ability to form conception is tensegrous with perception, it's very powerful. Very powerful indeed. And thought can be extraordinarily accurate. I've many times given you examples from my own personal meditative experience, and I'm sure that all of you have it also. What is important to recognize is that that straight line between conception and perception is an abstract happening, which if it occurs in life in that way, we call that ideal, and abstracted out of life, it's an ideal. So that when it comes to actual life experience, the tensegrity between conception and perception takes the form of a circle and not the form of a vector. Now, one of the easiest ways to understand this, I've singled out a paragraph here from the standard book on history of Chinese philosophy. This is by Feng Yulan, published by Princeton University Press in the early 50s and still is in print in paperback. And Feng Yulan here on page 185 is seeking to explain something in Chinese philosophy, what we are talking about here. And so in order to make his explanation clear about what Taoism really means, he uses a great Western philosopher of process to express accuracy. He uses Hegel. And it's interesting that the greatest Chinese philosophic mind of the 20th century would use a Western philosopher to explain the intricacies of Taoism. It is a very interesting process. And so mark it down in your conception that somehow there's a squiggle associated with the conception. East is different from West, and never the twain shall meet, which is a phrase misquoted, I'm sure, from Kipling. It's also a phrase which guides Carl Jung's mind. East and West are different, and never the twain shall meet. So I'm putting a squiggle in that conception because we're going to talk about Jung all day. But I want you immediately to understand that there are some limitations to Jung's thought, and that we should not be curtailed by his limitations. He's done many valuable things. Has contributed an enormous amount. But his writings of 50 or 60 years ago belong to the last century. But even in this century, if you had had exposure in a broader way, which he did not have, he had a standard cultivated European education, he would have realized that this, some of these conceptions that he prized were not so. The main squiggle to put in today is that there is an interchange between East and West, which is sublime. And in order to explain Taoism, a Chinese professor goes to Hegel. Just like when a Western philosopher now goes to explain some of the esoterica of the Hermetic tradition, one brings in Chinese thought. So that there is an interchange point. This is the visualization to have. Make an eidetic frame around this. There is an interchange point between East and West in their conceptions of process, especially when one has the process in its full range. You can use the term ecology here. Whenever there's a full, complete ecology of process, East and West, there is an interchange between the standpoints of East and West, so that it requires the other to adequately express conceptually what is only process in the other. To put it simply, if you're Chinese enough to really be Taoist, there's no way that you can conceive of Taoism correctly. And so what a Chinese will tell you on a real subtle level, if you get to that, is don't think about it. Just do it. And the same thing happens in the West. You're told at certain levels of subtlety, don't wait for the conception to form. Try it out. And if it works, use it. And later on, in retrospect, try and figure out what you're doing. So subtlety, East and West, both have this kind of a practical wisdom. Now, if you're just a beginning student, you never run across it. If you're an intermediate student, you rarely ever even hear about it. But on the important level that we have to address today, what makes magic work? Why does it work? The fulcrum, conceptually, for understanding why it works is that there is an interchange point in the ecologies of process, and that this is important. It's important to note and to highlight and to bracket eidetically in one's conceptual imagination. Now here's the quote from page 185 of Feng Yulan's Chinese Philosophy. Hegel has said that the process of history is always marked by the three stages of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. 1, 2, 3. Thesis, antithesis, or antithesis, and synthesis, or synthesis. When from one extreme something moves to the opposite extreme, this is the step from thesis to antithesis. There's a subtlety here which you have to pay attention to. Most second-rate thinkers, it never even occurs to them. It's the movement from thesis that produces the antithesis. The antithesis is not another thesis. It's the movement from the thesis that produces the antithesis. It's subtle, but oh, is it important? You cannot have accurate thought an accurate conception if you don't understand something just this simple and important. So that very often, the synthesis, the synthesis is the movement back from the antithetical direction. Now notice here that the antitheticality and the synthetic putting together, the differential and the integral, are opposites of each other. They're in fact 180 degree opposites of each other. And it turns out that whatever your antithetical movement is, whatever form that has, the synthetic movement, if it has the same form, will be consonant with it and will accurately divulge the true nature of the thesis. Now the whole point for 2,000 years before it became called old-fashioned and nobody did it anymore, the way that you learned to think in the West was to learn arguments. Not to have some goddamn opinion, whether, oh, I prefer this argument over that argument, but to learn all of the standard arguments, pro and con, so that you could give the arguments. Because the intelligence was not whether, oh, I have this opinion, I think this is right. That's foolish. That's not even worth coming into first grade. The training of intelligence was to be able to follow the arguments in their movement. Here's the thesis. And from that flows this argument form, the antitheticality of it and the synthesis of it coming back, so that one understood this is what this thought is. If I hold this thought, if I hold this thesis, this viewpoint, this is the form of its antitheticality, and this is the form of the synthesis coming out of that. So that one comes into possession then of a whole file load of alternates. You have many theses, but you understand what's going to happen if you hold those. So that the maturity of thought is based upon a judgment, not whether, oh, I like this opinion better than the other, but on the ability to understand that thought has its form and its motion and its stages, and it's going to happen. And it's better to be conscious of how it happens, its modus operandi, so that if you, in a certain situation, are holding some thesis, you're aware also that these other occurrences are going to follow. Now, if you don't know that, if you don't keep that in mind, then the antitheticality of it becomes unconscious. And also the synthetic capacity of it is also unconscious. And we live in a time where people feel empirically that, oh, well, none of this can be known. All of this is some mysterious, unconscious realm. It's due to sloppiness of mind. A great deal of it is due to sloppiness of mind and institutionalizing a false sense of liberty. You have the liberty to hold any opinion you want based on how you feel about it. Well, that's fool's gold. So here we have, and we've only gone through the first sentence of the first quote. This is quoted by Feng Yilan, trying to explain the intricacies of Lao Tzu and Taoism. Start again. Hegel has said that the progress of history, notice how history then for Hegel was a massive argument in motion, as it were. Whose argument is it? Hegel says it's a spiritual argument, and the implication is that history is God's argument. True history would be taking God's thesis of man and putting it through its ecology of its motion. Well, how do we know that? Well, that's the way that mind works. In the mind of God, we must have a mind that works in that way. And so the desire, the object is to try and understand now. Well, let's try and understand that person. Let's try to understand God's mind. And in order to follow that, one then has to conceive of history as a whole, first of all. This is exactly what Hegel was up to 200 years ago. And incidentally, went quite far with this. I'm just giving you little taster squares. There are whole libraries of development. Hegel has said that the progress of history is always marked by the three stages of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. When from one extreme something moves to the opposite extreme, this is the step from thesis to antithesis. What is most straight seems crooked. The greatest skill seems like clumsiness. Now he's quoting here from Lao Tzu and putting it into his use of Hegel, his explication using Hegel's ideas, conceptions of argumentative form. What is most straight seems crooked. The greatest skill seems like clumsiness. And I'll give you two examples so that you can appreciate that this isn't just cute talk. You've seen lightning. You know that lightning is a universal electromagnetic energy, and that it is a instantaneous discharge when the tension between the ground and the cloud mass is just right, and the energy always follows the shortest path. And if you look, you've never seen lightning in a single line. Never. The standard shape of lightning, which is everybody recognizes from their Captain Marvel comic days, the standard shape of lightning is that it's this jagged edge. And we know that empirically it has all kinds of crackling motions. It's never a straight line. The most straight seems crooked. And the greatest skill seems like clumsiness. Use a little homily here. I think all of you are old enough to have gone to a circus and seen the clowns come out and do acrobatic things. That it takes tremendous acrobatic quality to clown around with it, not just to do it. It's like that. What is most straight seems crooked. The greatest skill seems like clumsiness. And then he returns to using Hegel to explicate this mystery of Taoism. Were there merely straightness and skill alone, these would necessarily have to change into crookedness and clumsiness. But it is because they are of a straightness which contains crookedness and of a skill which contains clumsiness that they are called the most straight and the greatest skill. They are the synthesis arising out of thesis and antithesis. The integration, movement, the piece de resistance of the thought movement in its synthetic aspect restores back into the actuality, the actual unity, into the greatest straightness, some crookedness, and into the greatest skill, some clumsiness. So that on the conscious level, one uses the complete expression. For instance, I'm trying to teach you the entire pattern of consciousness in 2 years. And someone could say, well, why can't you diagram it and give it to us in one lecture? Well, I don't have any trouble. I can do that. But it wouldn't happen. What you would receive is a lie. You would receive an outline, a diagram, which then you would swallow whole and forget. It wouldn't register at all. It wouldn't be real. It'd be an interesting thought. That movement of the antitheticality, which has to be taken into consideration, and the synthesis, which also is a movement, has to be taken into consideration, is a part of the reality of any thesis, of any conception, of any idea. And I'll give you a little cartoon vignette, mnemonic image, so that you can understand this. Do you remember in comic books? Always when you got an idea in comic books, the light bulb would come on. The antithesis is reaching for the pull chain, and the synthesis is pulling the pull chain. No light comes on. One understands the thesis. These movements, this double movement, is essential in the Hermetic tradition in the West and in the Taoist tradition in the East. If you don't pay attention to that, indeed, a great deal of this universe is unconscious. A great deal of this is unknown. A great deal of the universe is dark matter which can't be accounted for. In Taoist language, in Chinese language, in its art mode, it's called the first principle of painting. That there is a life force mysterious movement. Or spirit movement, life force mysterious movement. And when we get into art, I'll give you the Chinese phrases for all of this, and you can see. It's the first of the six principles of painting. There is a life force spirit movement which is a realistic aspect every time one has an objective expression, which includes an idea. An idea is a very objective expression, actually occurs, is a thing. Most of you had trouble in the symbols part of the course to objectivize an idea, but that's nothing. Almost everybody that you would meet would have trouble objectivizing an idea. Those who can objectivize an idea are very rare right now in our world, and it's an uncanny ability. I'm just thinking of the first time that I realized somebody was objectivizing an idea was hearing a speech by a professor of mine at the University of Wisconsin. And it was quite a shock to realize that he knew what he was talking about. It was very objective. So ideation, the idea, and in Greek it's spelled with the iota, I-D-E-A, even in Greek. The idea is objective and is quite real. It's as real as any objective, and can be used as a thesis, as a starting point for a thought, and the conception not only has the idea, but has the idea in its movement towards antitheticality and its counter-movement back synthetically. So that when one has this in its completeness, you have, let me use a Buddhist Abhidharma model for just a second. In the Buddhist Abhidharma, each thought moment, it's called a citta, each thought moment has 16 parts. The first 8 parts are definite phase stages, which can be analyzed, incidentally, in a very accurately in a strong samadhi. 8 particular phase stages. The last 8 always occur as a trill. They never occur individually. They occur as a trill. They are always an ensemble, And that's the integration. The integration is so quick as to seem almost instantaneous. But the differentiation is definitely capable of being put out phase by phase by phase. One could specify it. If one had the capacity, as we do now, it doesn't take a very powerful computer at all to specify, to differentiate. Every phase that counts can be specified. So the differentiation as a process, the movement towards antitheticality, can be analyzed to whatever accuracy is required. You can analytically satisfy yourself that you've got it all down. There it is. We've got it all down. But the counter movement, the synthetic movement, cannot be analyzed in the same way. It has to be analyzed, as I said, I use the musical connotation here, a trill. It has to be taken as a movement, as it were. So this is a quality which is very, very important to realize. So that, returning here to Feng Yulan, those who comprehend the invariable know the male yet cleave to the female. Now, this is a quotation from the Lao Tzu, from the Tao Te Ching. Those that know the male cleave to the female. And you can write this the other way. Those that know the female cleave to the male. Now, in psychological terms, in Jungian psychological terms, this is a real problem area and results in misconception continuously. Continuously meaning that it's just an ongoing ignorance. Pitiful, actually. The key, analytically, to understanding what's wrong, why this most profound aspect is misunderstood constantly in Jung's thought, and it isn't just Jung's thought, that whole generation, that whole culture misunderstood this, is a confusion between two different kinds of oppositions. The confusion between yin and yang is an opposition, and between hun and po as an opposition. And to not know that they are different puts you into misconception instantly and permanently. Now, the core of the secret of the golden flower in its practice is built around the yin and the yang, but in its expressive ideation, it's built around the hun and the po. So that when Jung goes to write his commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower, he comes up with a Western parallel schmaltz instead of the real poignant accuracy that is there, Taoistic one. No reflection on Jung's intelligence. No reflection on his work being not trustworthy and so forth. Not that at all. There are very few people in the West that ever understood this right. Very few. I happen to be in a position because of life circumstance to have had the right teaching on this. I happen to have had a Chinese mentor, and I happen to have a Taoist degree from him. And before I went more public in bringing this out, I took it to the only resident Taoist master in the United States, Master Ni, and showed him my degree and talked with him for a while and have his approval to speak quite openly from my understanding. This particular problem is highlighted in The Secret of the Golden Flower. Wilhelm's book, The Secret of the Golden Flower, is a very esoteric manuscript which was given to him by his Taoist master. So that Richard Wilhelm had a Taoist master. And the old man was very careful. He realized that the world was changing in such a way that there wasn't going to be very many opportunities for Chinese Taoists to keep the tradition going. And to put it colloquially, to hedge on bets, he trained a Westerner as if he were his own son, as if he were in his own lineage, just like my teacher did, recognizing that this is a weird world and you can't count on lineages lasting anymore. It's like if the Tibetan Buddhists had remained in Tibet and put all their stakes in keeping their lineage alive in Tibet, it would have disappeared. It would have vanished. So Richard Wilhelm was one of those individuals who was singled out by a legitimate Taoist master to receive the teachings accurately and to be able to present them accurately, not represent them conceptually, but to present them using two different qualities simultaneously, life and consciousness simultaneously. Now, Richard Wilhelm balked at this after his translations began to come out, The Secret of the Golden Flower and the I Ching. He balked at this and he tried to go back and just be Western. He tried to be conceptual about it. He tried to be conscious of it, and the life force will kill you, which is why he died. He was 53 when he died. If you once engender this energy and you transgress, that's it. It's as certain as being electrocuted. Consciousness and life, when they are braided together, go together, and you can't then back up through the integration and go back and analytically spread them again. That will kill you. Just as sure as shooting. It's because of Richard Wilhelm's experience, because Jung understood that, that he was always cautioning Westerners, don't be in a rush to follow Eastern gurus. Why? Because those Eastern gurus that can talk to us have already made a very powerful transformation. They've already insulated themselves, as it were, from that kind of a deadly, perilous tension, and it's very easy to misunderstand and then to try and live by that misunderstanding, and that will do you in. Right away, in The Secret of the Golden Flower, Jung, in this foreword to the second German edition, gives us again, in this form, the admonition. I would like to take this opportunity to draw attention to certain misunderstandings to which even well-informed readers of this book have succumbed. Not infrequently, people thought that my purpose in publishing it was to put into the hands of the public a recipe for achieving happiness. In total misapprehension of all that I say in my commentary, these readers try to imitate the method described in the Chinese text. Let us hope these representatives of spiritual profundity were few in number. There's a poison sign right here, skull and crossbones. Why? For a Western conception to imitate an Eastern method is a mismatch. The Western conception has an antithetical definiteness to it, which is not there in the Eastern Synthesis movement at all. It doesn't matter how close your conception comes. It is structurally different from the integration movement. One might also put in here, not just east versus west, but ignorance versus wisdom. It isn't an east-west problem, it's a problem of ignorance and wisdom. The same thing happens in the Western esoteric tradition. One of the ways to test the atmosphere is to see, is a metaphysical teacher using diagrams, relying on diagrams? And if so, turn around and walk out. Somebody that starts with the diagrams is almost 1,000% certainly misinformed. The pattern making for its accuracy comes in the middle of the process and not at the beginning and not at the end. Because it's the reversal of the analytical process that gives you the synthetic insight in the first place. The very nature of it is that reversal of that analytical capacity, and the wisdom way is then to move on with it. So one has a motion and one has a curl in the motion, and then you go on. Or because sometimes it's graceful when human beings are accurate at this, when you're capable of this, it doesn't go so much like a full circle around, but it's like a wave form. So that the very structure of consciousness as a phenomena, and it is a phenomena, you can measure it, it registers, is a waveform. Registers as an energy waveform, because this is a truth. Not to know this is to be ignorant indeed. And not to live by this with your consciousness is to set oneself up as a target. Now, I want to emphasize the secret of the golden flower. I want to give you a chance to, those of you who have done this, to have your say before I come in. But please note these paragraphs down. I've outlined for you the core of the movement of Jung's conception in the first part of the commentary of The Secret of the Golden Flower. This would be the sections from the beginning over to, let's see, this goes up to page 44 in volume 13. So the commentary itself goes up to page 55. So I'm taking this sequence is the commentary minus the last 10 pages. The sequence is by paragraph numbers. Always when you work with the collected works of Jung, don't use the page number, but use the paragraph number. Everything in the indexes is cued to paragraph numbers, and it'll facilitate the accuracy of your checking on things. What am I saying? I'm saying that I'm giving you here a shape of Jung's idea, his thesis that he's working with in several of its various expressions, and if you want to check it through the rest of his works, like the power of an idea is not just to have the idea, but to see how it works. And you can, if you find someone's idea, if you objectivize it and you understand it, you can go back to all of their ideational expression, no matter what it is or where it is, and you can read it with an accurate index in terms of this thesis, his characteristic of his mind. It's in every one of his works. So in all 20 volumes, it's always operating. Sometimes expressed, sometimes not, but it's always there. And if you're conscious that it's there, you can read his works with a critical eye. This is what the critical eye is. To be able to see in terms of this idea, temporarily, while you're rotating that view through this line of expression. And you can do this. You can learn to do this. This is the essence of high magic. This is the very essence of it. Only instead of it being a knack which just an esoteric few have several hundred years ago, it was amplified and made available to the populations of the world, so that it is a general consciousness now, whereas it was very esoteric at one time. So this is the sequence of the paragraph numbers. Number 31, you can start with number 31, which, let's see, to help you out, that occurs on page 21, the circular movement and the center. Here's somebody's copy of Alchemical Studies. The circular movement and the center. So as you start with that, notice that I'm setting aside fundamental concepts, A, Tao. You don't need to look at that. Why do we not need to look at that? In any kind of a correct understanding, the Tao is zero. And you don't start with zero, you start with the first step. The saying is every journey begins with the first step. Well, the energy gear up to make that first step is an aspect of the Tao. And we don't start with that. We start here with the circular movement of the center. So it goes from paragraph 31 to paragraph 33 on the following page, and then to paragraph 37, which occurs a couple of pages further, then to paragraph 44, then to paragraph 47. Then you have the diagrams on pages 30 to 33. And then paragraph 52 at the top of page, or at the bottom of page 36. And then paragraphs 57, 58, and 59 are the key here. They're the core. 57, 58, and 59, they concern the Po and the Hun. And you might note for yourself that Po and Hun are not yin and yang. Just a little note here for you. I'm sure that all of you have heard this. Maybe not Dan or Dolores or Carol. In the Chinese dynamic, when the Po soul and the Hun soul are together, they're always together in a dynamic, and that dynamic is the qi, or the qi, however you want to pronounce it. The energy. The energeia, the life energy, the key is the Po and the Hun together. But that qi is analytically distinct from the te, which is the movement of the Tao. The qi of the Tao is te, not qi. Because you could have all the qi you want. And if you're not on a planet where you could use it, say you're in between star systems and a spacesuit adrift 1 light year from your spacesuit, and you're all alone in the cosmos, you can have all the qi you want. Not much you can do with it. But if you're in a world system where there's an ecology of life and a landscape and so forth, with that qi you can do a lot. Because there is a te that allows for it to amplify. So the qi of the Tao, as it were, is a te. The te comes from the yin and the yang together. And you see that it's without the yin and the yang, the Po and the Hun don't mean very much. Without the te of the Tao, the qi would be negligible. Scientifically negligible. yes, it is something, a very definite something, and it has tremendous capacity, but only because it's within a context of te. And the te only occurs because of the Tao. We'll wait for the cassettes to...